drive back. Bree was here last year when I spoke, and Rena is making her first time appearance. As we got closer, of course, Rena, despite having been warned, this is going to be a long ride and she shouldn't fetch. About an hour into the ride, she wants to know when we're going to be there, and the answer is not terribly soon. But as we got closer, I said to Rena, okay, we're in Philadelphia already. And of course, Rena's association with Philadelphia is Sandra Boynton's Philadelphia Chickens. So she was, you know, Philadelphia Chickens, right? That's the most famous work of children's literature associated with your hometown. You should know about Philadelphia Chickens. So Rena was very excited to know that we were coming to the hometown of the Philadelphia Chickens. This is not a typical shear sort of shear. There really is very little by way of direct Torah content here. And having said that, I think this is a vitally important topic for from women in the early 21st century. Because there are ways in which we are seeing the demands placed on us and the demands we place on ourselves right now sort of sped up, accelerated, intensified in a way that they frankly were not for our grandmothers and great-grandmothers. I'm going to try to hit on different stages and places in life, but those of you who are past the stages of raising young children, who are maybe at the stage of watching your daughters and daughters-in-law go through this, can probably attest to the fact that things look very different now than they did when you were in this stage yourself. And certainly some of the pressures and expectations on women are very different than they were. I want to talk about some of those pressures and expectations, kind of what they do to us. And then I don't want this to be a talk where we just say, okay, here are all the problems. Great, we've identified all the problems. It's been nice seeing you. Let's all go home. Given that this is a very real set of issues that very directly affects how we live our lives, I don't want to end without identifying some concrete what can we do. I don't want to just leave this with, oh yeah, that's a really big problem. Thanks, have a nice day. Okay? So, of course, welcome to the 21st century. I have notes for this talk. My mother is a public speaker of some note. My mother has all of her speech notes in big binders, by year, by topic, by everything. They're all in loose leaves. I called them loose leaves when I was a kid. Apparently now they're all binders. Big binders. I have all my speech notes on Google Drive. So, okay, I'm going to bring my iPad here with my notes. My iPad this morning is, for some reason, not connecting to Google Drive. No problem. I'm going to print my notes out. Very great. I have a 21st century networked wireless printer. You email the document to the printer. Nothing doing. My printer's not printing it this morning. Great. By now I'm up to the fourth device to get my notes on. So, you know, I'm not texting my kids at home to see how they're doing, but we're down to getting Google Drive on my phone. The backup of the backup of the backup of the backup. What are the expectations of us that we confront today as Orthodox Jewish women? Let's start with that. What are the expectations that we confront today as Orthodox Jewish women? Some of which our great-grandmothers might have confronted as well, many of which they did not. Number one, that we have some form of employment outside the home that contributes to our family's finances. That is increasingly a standard expectation of women in their lives, that it provide us with some intellectual challenge and personal fulfillment, but of course not too much. You don't want to take you away from home and family. The expectation of us is going to be that we marry and that we have children, have lots of children, with all of the concomitant physical demands, with all the physical demands that pregnancy, nursing, raising babies, child rearing imposes. And then when we're raising those children, of course, the expectation is that we parent wisely and reflectively. We don't just scream at them and slap them, even if that was good enough for our great-grandmothers. It is not good enough now. That we have, of course, a wonderful, loving, growth-oriented, and passionate marriage. Date night, anyone? Right? I love when you go to these things and they start telling you about how you and your husband have to find one night a week to go out together. Like, my husband and I find one night a week when we're home in the house at the same time, we're doing good. Never mind going out together. Cooking and serving on a regular basis, meals that your average American makes once a year and spends a month getting ready for. Right? I love. Pick up a Good Housekeeping, a November issue of Good Housekeeping. The, like, launching the D-Day invasion, we are making Thanksgiving checklists 4 weeks before. You know, I don't know what you could do for Thanksgiving 4 weeks before, but you're supposed to do it. 3 weeks before, 7 days before, 2 days before, 1 hour before. You're like, okay, that's one Thanksgiving meal for 15 people. On Sukkot, I do six of those, and then 6 days later, I do another six, right? If it's a 3-day Yom Tov. Maybe I do four of them, and 6 days later, I do another four. All of that we're supposed to do while we are eating right, exercising, and maintaining the same figure we had when we were 22. That goes without saying. And then we hit a certain stage in life where we are not only taking care of our kids, but we're taking care of our parents. And all of that is happening on top of an expectation of ourselves that we have a rich, meaningful, deep, personal, religious life. Those are the kinds of expectations that we are looking at and confronting as contemporary Orthodox women. So I want to talk about that, how we got to where we are, what we do about the reality that that is where we are, and some things to think about as we confront those realities. And again, I want to say that while the specifics of what confronts us are a little bit different at different stages in life, I'd like to talk about this topic even if it's not directly relevant for everyone here. If you're past this stage, but you're watching your daughters and daughters-in-law or granddaughters and granddaughters-in-law going through this stage, I'd like to suggest what you might be able to do or not do that would be helpful to them. If you are not yet in this stage but are looking forward to be in it, it might be helpful to think about and reflect on where we find ourselves. And as many constraints as we find and as many challenges as we find on Orthodox women today who are married and raising families, single adult women find only that many more challenges confronting them in terms of the expectations on them and the complexity and at the same time the narrowness of the expectations. So let's start by asking ourselves, how did we get to be here? Our great-grandmothers' lives did not look like this. How did we get to be here that so many different, conflicting, sometimes contradictory expectations are layered onto us? And I'm going to bring in from here a lot of different sources from a lot of different venues or a lot of different areas of life that I think offer us some insight as to how we ended up where we are. The first book that I'm going to talk about is a book written by an historian of technology named Ruth Schwartz Cohen. And Ruth Schwartz Cohen, C-O-W-A-N, not spelled like Jewish Cohen. Ruth Schwartz Cohen wrote a book called More Work for Mother, in which she looks at the history of housework and labor-saving devices in housework. Because you would think, now that you have a vacuum cleaner and a washing machine and a microwave and whatever other dishwasher, all these nifty-swifty labor-saving devices, that you should be doing much less housework than a woman 150 years ago or 250 years ago who had to bake her own bread and make her own candles. And in fact, what Ruth Schwartz Cohen finds is that labor-saving devices do not particularly tend to save women time from housework. What they do is they displace the time onto something else. So that, for example, when you did your laundry by taking it down to the river and beating it on the rocks, you washed your laundry much less often. We might be a little bit, you know, skeeved out to hear how infrequently historical figures changed their bed linen, or for that matter, changed their underwear. But the expectation that you were very, very regularly changing your clothing, your bed linens, and everything else was not the expectation, since washing them was so laborious and time-consuming. And there are many other such examples that she offers. If you think about all the discussions in Poskim, about koshering dishes for Pesach, koshering pots for Pesach, koshering silverware and glasses for Pesach, people had, you know, 8 plates, 8 cups, 8 forks, eight spoons, and then they koshered them all for Pesach. We are presiding over vast arrays of household goods, all of which now need to be cleaned, moved, maintained, dealt with, and everything else. It's already a joke how many of these like highly specialized one-function kitchen gadgets there are. I have to stop my sister-in-law from buying them for me. My sister-in-law gets very enthused. So she finds like a donut maker, and she's like really excited. She's going to buy me a donut maker. I'm like, Dietza, please, no donut maker. I don't have any room for the donut maker alongside the waffle maker, alongside the ice cream maker, alongside the cake pop maker, alongside the last 6 things that you found that were really, really exciting and would be totally fun for Sunday afternoon. And then they have to be washed and cleaned and put away and take up space in my kitchen for the rest of forever. When I'm not doing that one fun thing. I live in an apartment in Washington Heights. I don't have any room for a donut maker. My kids like looking at the Hamaker Schlemmer catalog that comes to our house. So they found a Hamaker Schlemmer device that will allow you to make toast or grilled cheese or something imprinted with your face. You send them a selfie, and you can make toast with your face on it, because clearly there is nothing all of us needs more in our lives than selfie grilled cheese. I mean, clear, that is just as obvious. So, you know. So one thing that has happened to us is that despite all the labor-saving devices and innovations, we find ourselves juggling expectations that are no less demanding, even if they are demanding differently. Next are the financial realities of life in late 20th, early 21st century United States, which means that the post-World War II reality that you could live a middle-class life on one income is increasingly not the case. Or it's the case for a very few people with very, very high-paying jobs. For all the rest of us, and this is not just a function of COLEL or not COLEL, it is a function of the world in which we live, of the expenses associated with the world in which we live. I asked my mother once. My mother told me that when she was little. My mother's a classic baby boomer. Her father served in the Army in World War II. My grandfather served in the Army in World War II, came back when World War II was over. My mother was born in March of 1946, like by the book, baby boomer. And she told me when she was a kid, you started school at 7. You started first grade at 7. And until first grade, you didn't go to school. I said, what did you do all day? She said, we followed my mother around, and we were bored. She went to the grocery, we went to the grocery with her. She went to the dry cleaners, we went, or whatever, the laundry, we went to the laundry with her. She went here, she did this, we followed her around, and we were bored. That was it. By now, if your kids make it to 3 without being enrolled in some kind of schooling program, there's something wrong with you, and you probably have them Suzuki violin after school, because, you know, brain stimulation, something, 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 and Pee-wee Little League, whatever it's called on Sundays, and 6 other places where we have to be running and going and doing. So in a variety of ways, the expectations have changed. But the mother is not home to take the kids schlepping around with her, even if we wanted to do that, because we are out working. And again, working, not necessarily always by choice, although let's own that also, right? I would choose to work even if I didn't have to work. I tell my kids sometimes, I think homeschooling is great. I think homeschooling would probably be the best form of education for a number of my children. I just don't want to stay home with them all day to homeschool them. If they could find someone else who wants to homeschool them, I think homeschooling for them would be amazing. I'm just not volunteering to do it. I do tell my students, and my students like whine at me. I say to them, if I wanted to be with somebody whining at me, I would stay home with my kids all day. So, you know, like, don't whine at me when I come to work. I'm not interested. But another thing that's going on are the financial realities of our lives. And we could have a whole conversation about yeshiva tuition. I have my thoughts about yeshiva tuition. I don't so much buy the framing of the tuition crisis, but I'd be happy to talk about that at some other point in time. But the reality is school costs what it costs. Something else that we have to talk about and understand is the impact of feminism on our religious lives. You're going to say to me, I'm not a feminist. I don't know what you're talking about, the impact of feminism on our religious lives. I am going to say the expectation that we have of ourselves that we have personally meaningful and fulfilled religious lives is a product of feminism, whether or not we understand and acknowledge that. My great-grandmother did not expect of herself that she have a personally meaningful and fulfilled religious life. She understood perfectly well that her husband was going to shul to daven and she was not. To the extent that Torah was being learned, it was not being learned by her. That was totally fine. That was the way it was. The fact that we don't think that that's totally fine is a product of our expectation that we, as adult women, as adult Orthodox Jews, are going to have our own religiously meaningful lives. Increasingly, we're dealing with women who have had serious Torah education through high school and beyond, who have had meaningful spiritual lives through high school and beyond, and the fact that I'm now in a different stage of life doesn't mean that I'm going to accept not having a meaningful religious life. Or if the pressures are such that I don't find myself with the space to do that, certainly it's going to be something that I feel bad about. Certainly it's going to be something that I feel bad about. So in addition to the sort of history of technology piece about labor-saving devices not saving us labor, and the economic piece, that two-parent households are really a necessity, two working parent households are really a necessity, we find ourselves with the piece that our expectations of ourselves are very different in terms of our religious lives, and so that becomes yet another expectation layered on top of other expectations. And then we have other ways, other broader ways in which our sense of what we can and should be doing, our senses of what we can and should be doing, are shaped by the world around us. So that broad trends in the world around us in terms of eating, in terms of conscious, thoughtful, almost like morally engaged food choices, are very much coming into our community and our world. It's no longer okay to just, I mean, some of you will say, oh, it's okay with me, but it's no longer okay to a lot of people to hand your kids a bag of gummy worms and say, here's Shabbos party, go kids, knock yourselves out, right? Somebody, I work in a high school office. There's a very nice program that brings adults with developmental disabilities into school offices to do work to feel like they are engaging productively as members of society. So they'll come into our office and they'll organize things, or they'll stuff envelopes, or they'll do whatever it is. They come, when the people who are coming to do this work in our school office come, they are accompanied by some kind of staff member from the organization that they are being sent by. And the woman who comes in with them is a Hasidic young woman coming into a modern Orthodox co-ed high school. And it is, the conversations that she has with the secretaries in the office are absolutely hysterical. Because she's about 40 years old and she's already married off a couple of her kids, because since her sons are getting married at 18, you know, she got married at 17 or 18, so this is not hard to do the math. She's already married off a couple of kids at 40 years old. And one day she did a job, this Hasidic young woman who comes into our school office, did a job on modern Orthodox Shabbos parties versus like Haredi Shabbos parties. And by the time she's done making fun of the pirate's booty and the veggie straws and all the other things that constitute modern, if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about, right? That constitute modern Orthodox Shabbos parties, because you wouldn't Chas v'Shalom give your kid gummy worms, so we're now up to pirate's booty and veggie straws. But that's a whole way of thinking and living. My mother, whom I love dearly, and she's wonderful in many ways and at many things, is making the same menu for Shabbos every week that she has made since I could remember Shabbos, and probably since before. And Bree's laughing because Bree knows Shabbos chicken in Bubby's house is?
Chicken with ketchup.
Ketchup chicken. Ketchup chicken. You dilute ketchup with water and pour it on the chicken and bake it in the oven. I once asked my mother, I finally, after like however many decades, where did ketchup chicken come from? Like, what is the concept of ketchup chicken? And my mother told me, such a, as a historian, this was so fascinating to me. She had an aunt who was born in, who was, I guess, doesn't make sense, her aunt was born in America. But she had an aunt who was like more American than the rest of them, I guess. The rest of them were more greenhorns and her aunt was more of an American. So she was the one you looked up to as the paragon of what high-class American living was. And this aunt of hers, who was a paragon of high-class American living, used to make chicken with ketchup. So that was like fancy cooking. Now, of course, it makes perfect sense because using processed foods was very much a marker of having been assimilated into American food ways. Because whatever you learned from Eastern Europe didn't involve ketchup because there wasn't any. So if you knew about Heinz and you knew about using ketchup, so that was a sign you were very American. So my mother had, whichever aunt was the fancy lady in the 50s who she knew from cooking with ketchup. So my mother remembered that when she started cooking, and here my mother is making ketchup chicken. To my kids, my modern Orthodox kids growing up in Washington Heights think that ketchup chicken is the funniest thing they've ever heard. And just so you know, a sister of mine, one of my sisters who lives in Lakewood, let me know. Her family likes it. She makes ketchup chicken. But we make fun of that kind of cooking now, or at least some of us do, right? The heavy and the sugar and the processed and the this, and we're trying to avoid and avoid and avoid and be super careful and not and watch and pay attention to, all of which becomes yet another expectation layered onto us. And all the things that we're trying to do, and you know what? And here is, if there's one takeaway I would like you to have from what I'm saying today, it is, you are not falling short. It cannot be done. No one person can possibly humanly do all of the things that we are asking that people do. It's just, it can't be done. It cannot be done. And again, if you're a mother of young children, I'm talking about living up to your own internal expectations of yourself, of what your home, your family, and everything else should look like, with the sort of side problem being what all the Yentas and Yasnos are going to say. If you're a single woman who's out there in the dating world, what the Yentas and Yasnos are going to say becomes much more important. And then it's not just a peripheral, I could shrug them off as long as I'm doing what I'm happy about, it's fine. The constraints on the options are only that much more, because what anyone and their brother-in-law might possibly say and think Okay, I wasn't planning on saying this, but I have to say it. So there's a very famous, he was really a literary critic. That's really what he was. Named Michel Foucault. You don't get through graduate school, probably you don't get through undergraduate school in many disciplines. My undergraduate major was physics, so you can, it turns out, get through an undergraduate major in physics without reading Foucault, but you can't get through any graduate school training in any humanities field without reading Foucault. And Foucault has a number of famous works that he's written, History of Sexuality, Discipline and Punish, but in one of his works, he talks about this idea of control by constant, permanent, everywhere observation and being watched. Oh, this is great. This has a Philadelphia connection. This is awesome. Okay, who here has been to the Eastern State Penitentiary? Okay, Eastern State Penitentiary, which is right here. Eastern State Penitentiary is a prison that was built in the early 19th century as a model prison for a new kind of prison. And that idea was penitentiary. You were going to get the prisoners to reform rather than just punish them. Okay? At Eastern State Penitentiary was built on this fascinating model. It's now a museum. I had a fellowship one year when I was in graduate school. I had a fellowship at the, I'm forgetting what it's called now. There's a Center for the History of Chemistry in Center City. And I had a fellowship with them. My doctorate's really about the history of physics, but I was writing about why do the physicists get all the credit and not the chemists, so the chemists liked my doctorate. Because I was implying that the chemists got the shaft and the physicists got the credit. So they gave me a fellowship to do research, to write for a year. But it was a fellowship you had to be in residence. So I was driving, I was commuting from New York City to Philadelphia for a year, which is a trip and a half. I don't recommend it. It was the year I was pregnant with Bree. Bree was born in April of that year that I was commuting from New York City to Philadelphia. And then I used to bring you with me to the Chemical Heritage Foundation. That's what it's called, the Beckman Center for the History of Chemistry. And that was before, this is a while ago, that was before Eastern State was open as a museum. It was this like abandoned, falling apart, tumble down, rumble down prison. And someone at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, for some reason I don't remember, had access, had keys, and took us one day on a tour. And it happened to be pouring. So it was like really environmental and spooky, and like it set the tone. Rain's coming in through the holes in the roof, walking through this dark, abandoned prison. It was great. So Eastern State Penitentiary was built on this panopticon model, this model of observation all the time as a way of controlling behavior. So it was built on a hub-and-spoke model with hallways of cells radiating off of central observation tower, guard tower, so that the guards could see into every cell at every time, at all the time. And the idea was that if you knew somebody was watching all the time, so then, you know, you'd behave appropriately and do what you're supposed to do. And so Foucault has this old, whatever he's saying about this notion of being watched all the time as a way of maintaining good behavior. But I want to say that to be a single adult in our community is very much to be subject to the panopticon model. You know, you never know. My mother used to say this to me all the time, and I was a whole 23 when I got married, right? You never know who might see you. You never know where you're going. And I was like, let's often leave me alone. My mother was very worried. So you're living under constant surveillance. So however much I'm talking about these different pressures and these different demands being layered upon women who are at the stage of mothering young children, the stage of life of being a single adult is a stage really of living under surveillance. There's not much more to say than that. A stage of living under surveillance, right? However, these many demands are... you should have a job, but like not too much of a career that might draw you away from your family. You should maintain a certain physical appearance. You should be religious in certain ways, but not too religious. However much those expectations play out in the lives of women who are at the stage of mothering young families, they play out, I think, in even more restrictive, even coercive ways on single adult women. Okay, so can't do it all. Cannot be done. It cannot be done. It simply cannot be done. I want to actually skip the first source by Arlie Hochschild. Arlie Hochschild is part of the diagnosis of the problem. She's a sociologist who wrote a book that is actually a very important book in understanding and framing this problem. It's called The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. And although she wrote this book in 1989, and she looks at what she calls an incomplete revolution, it is in fact still incomplete today. Many of the things she diagnoses about the difficulty of women being stuck managing this second shift, right? You have one shift that you do at work, and then you come home, and are still very true today. I read early in my graduate school career. So there's a feminist writer named Naomi Wolf who kind of wrote a series of books, like whatever stage she was in life then, that's the book she wrote. So when she was up to having babies, she wrote a book called Misconceptions about feminist analysis of childbearing and child rearing. And one of the things she wrote in her book was that all of these men that she and her friends were married to, so we're not talking about orthodox men, right? We're talking about very liberal, very feminist men. In fact, when the children arrived, lapsed into reasonably traditional patterns in terms of expectations of who was doing what around the home and who was taking what responsibilities. And she said even in her circles, now granted her book was written about 15 years ago, but I'm guessing that as much has changed, plenty still has not changed. Even in her circles of self-consciously feminist men, of men who believed about themselves that they were very liberal and were equally sharing everything, that once the kids arrived, certain old patterns of division of labor within the home were lapsed into, in which the women were in fact working the second shift. So Hochschild's book is very well worth reading and says a lot of interesting things. Chapter 2, Marriage in the Stalled Revolution, but I don't want to read that right now because that's still on the diagnosis of the problem part, and if we spend this much time on the diagnosis of the problem, we're never going to get anywhere towards talking about what a solution might look like. And so instead, we're going to move ourselves towards steps towards a solution. The second quote I have, the second source I have, is a quote from an interview in the New York Times Magazine in 2013 with Deborah Spahr. Deborah Spahr is the president of Barnard College. And I actually want to read you something. I read this interview in the New York Times, and she was talking, the interview was done around a book that Deborah Spahr published called Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. So having read this interview, I wanted to get the book. I'm at the stage of life where it's easier to order a book on Amazon, go to a library and read it and see if it's any good before you buy it. So I bought the book and then discovered to my disappointment that there's like one really chapter in the book, really great chapter in the book, which is the chapter that talks about these things, and a lot of other filler that's kind of meh. She really had like one great chapter and then she sort of turned it into a book. So there's a lot in the book that's not necessarily worth reading, but I want to read you from the chapter in the book that is absolutely worth reading. The result of these conflicting pressures is a force field of highly unrealistic expectations. Almost by definition, a woman cannot work a 60-hour week in a high-stress job and be the same kind of parent she would have been without the 60-hour-a-week job and all that stress. She cannot save the world and look forever like a 17-year-old model or bake a perfect cheesecake the night before a major presentation. No man can do this. No human can do this. Yet women are repeatedly berating themselves for failing at this kind of balancing act, and quietly, invidiously berating others when something inevitably slips. Think of the schadenfreude that erupts every time a high-profile woman hits a bump in either her career or her family life. Poor Condoleezza Rice, left without a boyfriend. Sloppy Hillary, whose hair is wrong again. She could not pull it off, snicker, snicker. She paid for her success. She could not do it all. Of course she could not do it all. No one can. No one does. Okay? And then she says something very interesting, which is, that the revolution of feminism was supposed to be that the world changed. That the world made space for people to work and have a full-time job and have a family. That the world made space for different understandings of professional success. That the world made space for different paths and different. Instead, she says, what happened is we turned it inside. We turned it towards ourselves. So instead of it being the world has to change, it became I now can, so I have to. If I can, as an adult woman in the Orthodox world, have a meaningful religious life, then I have to get up and daven vasikin and go out and come home before my husband goes out to shul because, like, why am I being lazy and staying at home? If I can have a career and then somehow try to figure out how I'm also going to the shul function, the PTA event, my friend Simcha this year, and, oh, tomorrow's orange day. He needs an orange tea. I wish the preschools would stop with these color days. It's great that my four-year-old son is learning the names of color in Hebrew. Why do you think I own a red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, and pink t-shirt for my four-year-old son? And even if I did, I mean, like the endless, I cannot even tell you, Did you check his knapsack? We didn't check his knapsack. We didn't know today was white day. He's the schlepper in the picture who's not wearing the white shirt. Because, you know, now, the modern technology, it's amazing. So alphabet notebooks used to just be whatever. You learn the alphabet. That was in the alphabet notebook. Now they keep taking these digital pictures of the class. Like for Kaf, they're all dressed in kahol. They're all wearing blue. And they paste the blue picture into the alphabet notebook. So immortalized forever is that Yosef Dov Schwartz is sitting there in the front row in a blue t-shirt on orange day. Because blue week, Kaf, you get kahol and katom, right? So you got to, it's not even one day. It's 2 days you got to remember for Kaf week. And like the whole, I can't handle the pressure. I just can't do this, you know? If I get him in a blue shirt on kahol day, I'm already doing good. Katom day was like, you know, and then the next week is Lavan, and then he didn't wear Lavan either. I'm so happy he's learning his colors in Hebrew. If there was any human way to do it without sending me home little notes about what color t-shirt I have to own, have clean, and remember to put on him the next day, I would appreciate it very much, okay? My generation, says Spar, made a mistake. We took the struggles and the victories of feminism and interpreted them somehow as a pathway to personal perfection. Not about changing society, but about changing me. We privatized feminism and focused only on our dreams and our own inevitable frustrations. I don't care what balance you negotiate in your own life. I don't care what you do or what you don't do. If you hear anything from me today, I categorically reject the guilt that many Orthodox women are living with. And I want us to avoid the dissatisfaction that comes with constantly beating ourselves up and feeling guilty. And I think we need to take some measure of responsibility that our worldview, our orientation, the way we think and talk about things contributes both to that guilt and to that dissatisfaction. And I actually think that it's really important that we start thinking. Rena, watch the coffee, sweetheart. I think it's important that we start thinking and talking about things differently as a way of mitigating that guilt and dissatisfaction. And if you say to me, the way we talk doesn't make a difference, you know that that's wrong and you know that it does. I, in my not all that long life, have lived through certain words that you could once say that you can no longer say. Okay? If you use the word retard as an insult around anyone under the age of 25, they are going to say to you, how could you say that? You can't say that. That's a bad word. You can't say that. You can't say something that is dismissive of or making fun of kids. I was once present, a colleague of mine, a high school teacher, said in front of her daughter, a high school student in the high school, so I was present, that something was retarded. And her daughter took her apart in front of me. And I felt bad for my colleague, who was clearly embarrassed, not embarrassed that her daughter took her apart, embarrassed that she had slipped that way and said that. Because she also knows you can't say that, but she's older than I am. She grew up at a time when you could say that, and you can't say that. And she was embarrassed that she had said it in front of me, and her daughter had no compunction about saying, like, how could you say that? You can't talk that way. And we know that changing the way we talk changes the way we think and changes culture. It 100% does. So how do I want us to change the way we talk? Number one, first and most important, we have to kill the whole "she's so amazing, I don't know how she does." You know, there was a novel written a few years called "I Don't Know How She Does It." That was the name of the novel. And it was about a woman who was, you know, working some high-powered job in London finance and then also trying to do all these other things. And, of course, it's not going to surprise anybody that she really wasn't doing this. There's one scene in that novel where her kid is supposed to bring a pie to school the next day for a bake sale. And she had no time to bake a pie, so she buys a pie from the bakery. But then to make it look homemade, she, like, whacks it around and beats it up a little bit so that the pie looks homemade. I am telling you, I give you my blessing when there's a bake sale. Buy a something and send it into the bake sale and be totally frank and open and say, I'm sending you a bought pie for the bake sale. Because that's how I do it. Don't sit around saying, she's so amazing, I don't know how she does it. No one is amazing, and no one is doing everything. Every one of us is making our compromises, is cutting something short somewhere. When you look at someone else, all you see is the way she's doing it. You don't see the compromises she's making. You don't see the way she's falling short. You see the things you are sensitive about yourself, because you know you're not doing them perfectly, and you assume she is, she's not. And I say this as somebody who gets this all the time. You're amazing. I don't know how you do it. I have my own professional job in the Orthodox community. My husband is a rabbi. I have 5 kids. I get all the time, "You're amazing. I don't know how you do it." I said, you know why I think I'm amazing? Because I don't carry my living room around on my back like a snail. So you don't know what my living room looks like, so it's very easy for you to think I'm amazing. If I put on a scarf and I put on earrings and I go out of the house, I look like I have something going on. Do you want to know what my house looks like right now? I have a 4-year-old son who, unfortunately, was afflicted with a virus all Shabbos, the details of which I will spare you with. The mountains of laundry are like up unto the heavens. We started laundry the second Shabbos was over, but he's generating laundry faster than we can wash laundry. You don't want to know what my house looks like right now. But I'm all here with like the earrings and the scarf, so you think I got something going on. You don't know that I yell at my kids. I am a yeller. Bria will attest to that. Okay? I am not one of these parents who's like, Shefala, perhaps we could think. I have sisters who work very hard at parenting that way. It takes a ton of time. It takes a ton of effort. They go to classes. They go to refresher courses. They invest enormous effort on being more thought through, wise, sensitive. Iska arbit is the Yiddish word. Like every word that comes out of their mouth is worked out, worked through. That's Mike Moore, how I parent. Everything, anything that we talk about, you go into someone's house for a Shabbos meal, you see what they're serving, you see what they're serving on, you see what they're doing, you don't see what they're not doing. You go to shul, you know who's in shul earlier than you, dominating more than you, their kids are sitting more quietly than your kids, right? You know, you only know what's working for someone else, you don't know what's not working. I will tell you one thing about being a Rebbetzin, is you find out, like everybody's, not everybody's, but people who come to talk to you, you find out what their stuff is, and you discover that lots and lots of people have lots and lots of stuff. Increasingly, I think we all have stuff. That's basically the story. We just all have different stuff. And you look at somebody else, and you're like, oh, they don't have this stuff. She is going to every shiur. She is effortlessly a size 2. She is a very thoughtful, wise, and insightful parent. She has a beautiful home. She has an amazing career, and she's so professional, she's so advanced, and she's so good. That's what you see. You don't see what's going on before. So I'm a very big believer in not telling these kinds of like Mephis stories, these wonder worker stories about other women. She's amazing. She did these amazing things. Don't tell those stories. They don't help. First of all, they're not true. She did an amazing thing, but you don't know what compromises she made, what corners she cut, what everything. I now have 5 kids, the youngest of whom is in school, and I have full-time help in my house. That's how I do it. I'm out working a very full-time job. My husband is out working a very full-time job. How do I do it? I have full-time help in the house with no kids at home. That's not a wonder worker story. That's what I need to do to make it work. It was not going to work otherwise. I'm paying a lot of money for a baby, well, not a, you know, whatever, babysitter, housekeeper in an empty house. Because that's the only way it's going to work. If somebody is cleaning my house 5 days a week because I'm not. Those are the kinds of stories we should tell. Real, true stories about how you make it work. Not wonder worker stories that make us all feel bad. And frankly, they make the person you're telling them about feel bad because she knows how not true they are. She knows. So my sister-in-law who buys the donut makers, when I was engaged to my husband and I was in graduate school and she then was doing her doctorate and her husband was doing his doctorate. They have both since finished and I finished. We're all done. But she was then a 2 PhD family, and I was doing my doctorate. My husband was in smicha, and I was in her house on Friday afternoon, and she brought me over to the stove, and she was like, let me show you the secret of how you make Shabbos with 2 working parents, both of them doing doctorates. And she showed me sitting on the blech, the Shabbos takeout special from Wok Tov, the Chinese restaurant in Cedarhurst. That was more helpful to me as an engaged woman in thinking about the realities of life. It's fine if you need to buy Shabbos from Wok Tov. That's totally great. That's grand. Or you could say you don't want to buy Shabbos from Wok Tov and you're going to do something else. But this like beating myself up because I'm buying Shabbos this week isn't helpful. Telling real stories about how we really do it is helpful. I have a sister, another sister. I got a lot of sisters. I have another sister who is very, very successful in the things she does. And that success has been very hard-earned. And she was actually invited to come speak at a girls' high school in Brooklyn where she lives to talk about how she managed her career as a public school teacher and her private work as a reading therapist. And her husband was sitting at that point, sitting in Kollel, supporting her husband in Kollel, and they wanted her to talk about to the high school girls about how do you do it. My sister said, oh, it's really simple. You know how you do it? Hard work. I work really hard. That's how I do it. There's no big secrets. There's no, you know... But part of that truth-telling is telling the truth about what things we do to make it work for us. And everyone's going to tell you something different. Everyone's going to tell you something different. But at the end of the day, and you know what? The things that we... A different one of my sisters, called me at one point. She had an infant. So I'm actually a little crunchy granola about these things. Like I had all my babies with midwives. I do that whole thing. So she was calling me almost like to give her permission... And you understand this was not her first kid, and she was working a full-time job, and to almost give her my blessing that in the middle of the night for one feeding, her husband would give the baby a formula bottle instead of being 100% absolutely pure breastfeeding. And she's calling me because I'm the crunchy granola one. I should kind of say, like, it's okay if you do this. I'm a very big believer in a parenting philosophy called whatever works. If that's what works for you, go ahead and do it. Your kid is not going to be scored, and they're not going to have a lower IQ because they got a formula bottle once in the middle of the night for the first however many months of life. I promise you. First of all, the research about breastfeeding is much more mixed than like La Leche League would want you to think. And I tell you this as somebody who did, in fact, nurse all of our kids, but the research about how it's going to help all of your kids, you know, have genius IQs and never have asthma is much more mixed than they would want you to think. Again, that's without a knock on breastfeeding. I did it in all grand, but you know what? If you have to give your kids formula, give the kids formula, they'll be fine too. And certainly, if you're nursing most of the time and you need that one relief bottle in the middle of the night so you can get 6 straight hours of sleep. So let's tell those stories. Let's tell the story of, oh yeah, you know me, super crunchy granola, and here's what I did in order to make it work. I prioritize my kids' Shabbos morning over going to shul, which is why, despite being the Rebbetzin of shul, I basically almost never go. I have different kids with different issues and different challenges, and we have to herd them out of bed every morning to get them to school, and it's not always easy. I'm not doing that to them on Shabbos. I'm not doing it to me on Shabbos. I'm not doing it to them on Shabbos. So I never come to shul. So someone saying the Rebbetzin never comes to shul, great, they could say. That's the corner I'm cutting, because 5 days a week, 6 days a week, because one of my kids has school on Sunday, we're getting everybody up and out and moving every day. Shabbos, I'm not pushing people. You know, I'm not pushing people out of the house. A long time ago, I decided that dessert was going to be a place. If I buy dessert every week, I buy dessert. If guests bring us dessert every week, they bring us dessert. Until now, my kids are old enough, I tell them to bake something. So that's how stuff gets baked. But until then, I was like, I'm cooking, I'm not baking. I'm not doing, it's not what I'm doing. I don't make my kids' birthday parties. Every kid gets one birthday party over the course of their elementary school career. 1 year, you get a birthday party. There is no way that I'm committing a Sunday per kid per year. And the whole busyness and the whole project and the whole undertaking, and I have one kid born on Pesach and one kid born 3 weeks before Pesach, there's just no way. I'm not doing that. Those are my corners that I cut. Your corners that you cut are different. I was actually surprised. This is, at least I was good enough not to say anything. Because the corners that we cut are different. I daven one Shmona Esrei every day. And it's usually not Shacharis, it's usually Mincha. I daven Mincha with a minyan every day because I work in high school, there's a minyan, I daven Mincha with a minyan every day. A sibling of mine told me that she hadn't davened Shmoneh Esrei, like, except, you know, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and how many years she couldn't, like, remember, and this was her thing that she was doing. She was actually, despite being in the state of she was parenting young kids, she was actually going to try to start davening ever. So, I was like, a little bit, I was surprised to hear that she didn't daven ever, but at least I know enough to know, and this is, we're getting to the next thing you could do to help to keep my mouth shut. And I say, what? You don't ever daven? I'm really a little surprised to hear that from you, all things considered. Because the next thing that I'm going to say, and this is particularly relevant if you're not in the stage of doing it, you're watching someone you love and care about go through the stage of doing it, is don't give advice unless someone comes to ask you for it. My mother quotes someone she once heard in a speech who said, unsolicited advice is an act of aggression. It worked for you, that's great, that's grand. Don't go to the woman in the supermarket whose kid is throwing a fit, climbing, screaming, and say, you know, if you just eliminated white sugar and food dyes from his diet, really, I found it's very helpful. Good, so I have nothing to feel guilty about. I have nothing to feel bad about. After a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of worry and a lot of concern and a lot of consultation and a heck of a lot of psychiatrist bills, I finally decided to put this kid on medication because we realized how out of control he is and how some lady in the supermarket is going to make me feel guilty because if I only took away white sugar and read number 40, he wouldn't need the Adderall. Maybe yeah and maybe no. Don't offer advice. Don't offer advice to your friends. Don't offer advice to your sisters. Don't offer advice to your daughters and daughters-in-law, even if that's hard. You know they're living a different reality than you lived. I ask myself this all the time. I don't know the answer. When I was a kid, never mind when my mother was a kid, when I was a kid, there were many fewer kids going to many fewer therapists. I don't just mean psychological therapists. I mean speech therapy. I mean occupational therapy. I mean physical therapy. I mean there was no such thing as low muscle tone, and there was no such thing as sensory anything, and there was no such thing. I don't necessarily mean there was no such thing. There was no diagnosis. There was no treatment. There was no busyness. If your daughters-in-law are super busy with the kid who needs, who has, and they're running and doing, saying to them, well, you know, maybe things would be better if you would just be at home more with him, is not helpful. It's just not helpful. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. Don't offer advice unless someone comes to ask you, like my sister came to ask me if it's okay that she gives a relief bottle. Unless someone comes to ask you, I'm really glad you're keeping her entertained, Bree, but those are my notes also. It's okay. We'll be okay. I thought that was my phone. No, that's the iPad. Great. We're good. Yes, they're on my phone. Thank you. Don't give advice. You want to know what you can do? If you're a parent-in-law, a grandparent-in-law, you know what you can do? You can give hands, you can give help. If you can do it, you can give money. And you can't give hands or help or money because you can't. Because you can't, because you yourself are still working full-time and you don't have the time, because you yourself are no longer in a situation where you can chase little kids around the house, because you're not in a position to give money, that's great. But don't give advice. Don't give advice. If you're out of it, you forget so quickly what it's like. And then you're like so smart and you're, you know, to tell you a quick forgetting what it's like story. I have a nephew who's a challenging little sprout. Plenty of kids are challenging little sprouts. He gets along very well with my parents. He goes to their house sometimes. My mother, in the course of a conversation with me, tells me with like horror and outrage that she came into her kitchen one night at midnight and found him standing on the counter, rummaging through the cabinets looking for candy. And she can't believe the horror that this child was standing on her counter rummaging through her cabinets. I was laughing my head off because I was like, Ema, we did that about twice a week and three times on Shabbos. In fact, my brother once climbed up on top of the refrigerator to get the Shabbos cereals that were kept on top of the refrigerator and got stuck up there and couldn't get back down. It was like, Avraham Yitzchak's on top of the fridge, someone has to get Avraham Yitzchak off the fridge. But my mother doesn't remember now what it was like in those crazy years when little kids were climbing up. So now it's, oh my gosh, it's terrible. They didn't civilize their child. He's climbing on my counter and going through my cabinets. Exactly like all six of your children who are reasonably functional adults. But you don't remember what it's like if you're not in it. My 4-year-old who's sick now, so he was up all night Friday night. My husband and I took shifts. I was up till 2:30, then he woke me up and I was up there. You forget what that's like, that sleep-deprived horror where your eye, you can't think a coherent thought or say a coherent sentence. Don't give advice. Don't give advice. Don't give advice to your peers. Don't give advice to your friends. If someone asks you, you can tell them what worked for you. But otherwise, advice is so often, if you did what I did, but there are so many reasons that somebody can't necessarily do what you did. But I also want to tell you the flip side of that. The flip side of don't give advice, which is how you interact with other people, something that my mother says often, which is that peer pressure is us. Peer pressure is us, which means the choice to feel peer pressured by something somebody else says is a choice that I am making. If I'm in the playground on Shabbos afternoon with someone who's playing, or if I'm in a and she mentions to me that she only feeds her kids organic, or if I'm in a conversation with another woman and she says to me, you know what really worked for me to lose weight is I did Suzanne Summers and that really worked for me to lose weight. I don't have to take that as an implicit criticism. I don't have to take that as a suggestion for what I was supposed to do that now I go home and beat myself up about. We have to cultivate an ability to say, isn't that nice for you? That's great. So great that that works for you. So great that it works for you to feed your kids organic. So great that Suzanne Summers worked for you. So great that whatever it is. In the handing out advice side, we have to not hand it out. And in the hearing people talking, we have to be able to hear people talking without hearing everything as an implicit judgment that sends us into some tailspin of feeling bad about ourselves and feeling like we're not doing enough and feeling like we're falling short and feeling awful. We have to cultivate an ability to hear. That's great. That's so great for you. And all the things that often come up in the, you know, sort of the generic conversations of just life, that somebody says, oh, I never use paper plates on Shabbos. Great. That's lovely. I use paper plates every Shabbos. I never give my kid gummy worms. My kids eat gummy worms for breakfast. We could go on. I exercise every morning, right? We could go on. If I didn't go to my shiur every week, I wouldn't feel like the same person. That's all fine. It's all great. We don't have to hear that as a judgment that we now beat ourselves up about. We could say, great, those are the choices you've made. The choices I've made are different. My choices work for me. Your choices work for you. We don't have to turn everything into the peer pressure that we let it be. And that lets us... That not lets us, but that pushes us to feel negatively about ourselves and about our choices and about our lives. There aren't wrong and right choices here. There are obviously some wrong choices, but there is a very broad spectrum of different right choices. You want to take your kid off of white sugar and red number 40, that's a right choice. I want to take my kid to a psychiatrist and prescribe medication for them, that's a right choice. You want to say, I think she's going to grow out of it, I'm going to leave it alone for now, that's a right choice. You want to say, I'm going to be a little bit more aggressive about early intervention. We don't have to hear someone else's casual comment about something they've done in their life and take that as judgment and a reason to feel bad about ourselves. I had a neighbor, she recently moved to Passaic, but lived with us in Washington Heights for about 15 years. Many years ago when our big kids were little, we were in the park where they had those like little Tykes plastic playhouses. And some of the kids were climbing on the roof of the Little Tykes plastic playhouse. She wouldn't let her kids climb on the roof. And one of her kids said, well, other kids are climbing on the roof of the Little Tykes plastic playhouses. And she said a line that I've been quoting ever since. So, Omer Devar B'Shem Omro Mevigu Lalolam. This is Daphne Weiner's line. Different children have different emas. That didn't bother her. Okay, their parent let them. I don't let my... Different children have different emas. Different women make different choices. Different homes have different rules. Different lives have different patterns. And we have to be able to say that to ourselves. As much as we have to control ourselves from saying to other people, what? You never that much money. I'm a little surprised to hear that. We also have to control ourselves when other people say things to us. Oh, it's so meaningful to me that I go to Vasikin every Shabbos before my husband goes. Great. Fabulous. That is lovely. I'm so happy for you to hear that. Instead of always hearing something as a, you know, as an implicit judgment. I want to say one other thing, which I guess is in the realm of Mifus stories, or rejecting Mifus stories, but I want to say it specifically because I think it's a particularly pernicious myth in our community, and I'm going to address that very quickly because I'm like way out of time, and then we can take questions. The particularly pernicious myth in our community is that the way to resolve all these issues and get everything done is not to sleep. It's not to sleep. Sleep is for weak people. Sleep is for wusses. Sleep is for people who are not as tough and strong and courageous as I am. We tell these Mifus stories that I can't stand about women who make it on 4 and 3 and 2 and no hours of sleep a night. There is a tremendous amount of research. Everything I gave you here, by the way, are things that I just think it's worth reading about these topics. So you can read them. If you look at number 3 is what not to do. What not to do. Jewish Action in 2012 ran an article called Striking a Balance, Work and Family. They profiled a number of modern Orthodox women or Orthodox women who are doing it all. And one of them is this very well-known OBGYN in the Queens and Long Island community, a Frum woman who's an OBGYN and has her own 7 or 8 kids and whatever it is, named Jessica Jacob. If you look at the second underlined paragraph, Jessica Jacob says she learned to forego sleep in medical school and continues to get up at 4:30 in the morning to work out on the Stairmaster even after nighttime baby deliveries. Jessica Jacob is a wonderful woman and a wonderful doctor, and I have nothing against Jessica Jacob. But somewhere in medical school, she might have learned that sleep is a necessity for healthy human bodily function. We have now learned that sleep, 100 things we know about sleep, including that people who are sleep deprived function at the same level as people who are drunk. Driving when you're completely sleep deprived is the functional equivalent of driving drunk. We know that enormous numbers of car accidents are caused every year by people who either fall asleep behind the wheel or just whose reaction time and decision making is so impaired by their sleep deficit that they crash their truck. I don't think that writing an article in the Jewish Action about how one way these women do it is by never sleeping is a particularly helpful or useful thing to do. If you look at source number 5, I'm not going to read it to you now, Brown Fryer, Sleep Deficit, the Performance Killer. This is from Harvard Business Review. These people are not hippie skippy. They're not hippie and they're not skippy. They are hard-nosed business executives who are trying to figure out how to get the most performance out of their employees. And what they are saying, look at the underline in the second paragraph because this is so important. Encouraging a culture of sleepless machismo is worse than nonsensical. It is downright dangerous and the antithesis of intelligent management. I love that phrase, sleepless machismo. I got 4 hours of sleep last night. Well, I got 3 hours. Oh, I got 2 hours of sleep last night. Ding, 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 you win. How about I made a choice not to do X because I function better, my house is happier, my life is saner, my metabolism works better, and everything else when I get 7 hours of sleep a night, like every human being person needs, and therefore I didn't go to X or I didn't do Y. That's not going to happen all the time. Of course it's not going to happen all the time. The night before a major presentation is due at work, you're going to be up late. Last night was my high school dinner. I got home at 12:30. This morning I had to leave my house at 7:30 in the morning to drive here from New York City, and there was my sick son in between. We're not always going to get as much sleep as we need. But instead of valorizing not getting sleep, we are going to recognize that as a sometimes thing we need to do to get something done. And if it becomes a permanent thing you need to do because that's the way you live your life, you probably need to rearrange how you live your life. It is not healthy for human beings to attempt to go, they've done sleep, I'm really stopping now. They've done sleep studies. You know how to do a sleep study? They put you in a room, like a sensory deprivation room, basically. No light, no nothing, totally dark. Not dark, but totally cut off from the outside world. No cues is what I mean from sunlight as to whether it's day or night. and they watch what happens with you. They do this, some of the famous sleep studies they did with recruits in the military, because who else could you lock up in a box for a month and watch what they do with sleeping? But if somebody's like a, you know, a private in the army, you're like, private, you've been assigned to this box for a month, and then you just do a sleep study on them. Basically what they've discovered is there isn't actually such a thing as a person who needs 4 hours of sleep a night. When they put people in this room, in this box, everybody, two interesting things happen. First, they catch up on sleep deficit, which you can do to a point. They find people sleeping enormous amounts until they catch up to, on their accumulated sleep deficits. And then just about everybody sleeps 7-8 hours a night, when left to their own devices. That means that everybody who's saying, I need 5 hours of sleep a night, is saying, I am functioning on a permanent sleep deficit of 2 to 3 hours a night. That's not the same thing as I need 4 hours of sleep a night. That's I'm functioning on a permanent sleep deficit of 2 to 3 hours every night. That's not a healthy way for us to be. It's not a healthy thing for us to do. And when we think about where we, I won't even say cut corners because I don't like that term. Barbara Spahr uses the term, you can read it here, satisfice, which is a term from economics. Satisfice is really a fancy economics term for saying what's good enough. Where do I not have to be the best? Where could I be good enough? When we think about where we satisfice, one of the things that should be baba cheshbon, that should be included in the conversation, is how much sleep do I need and how am I getting it? And at a minimum, even at a time when it's the week before Pesach, it's the week before the project is due at work, whatever is going on is going on, when I'm getting no sleep, again, changing how we speak changes culture. Let's not have sleepless machismo conversations. Let's not do it. Let's not create a culture that says that she who gets the least sleep wins. Not healthy, and it's not healthy to communicate that to our kids and to the people around us as a value any more than we would think that having a conversation about who ate the least food. I mean, I hope we wouldn't think that would be a healthy conversation to have or to have around our kids. I think as a community we've gotten to the point where who ate the least food is not a conversation that we're having in public or having around our children. Okay, I was asked to stop about 25 minutes ago to make space for questions, but we started late, so I'll use that as an excuse. I want to briefly recapitulate and then conclude. We, as women in the Orthodox world today, are asking an enormous amount of ourselves. We are asking an enormous amount of ourselves if we are the heads of households and mothers of young children. We are asking an enormous amount of ourselves if we are adult, single women in the world of looking for shidduchim. We are asking an enormous amount of ourselves just by virtue of the lives that we lead. It can't all be done. No one person can do and do well all of the things that we ask of ourselves to do. If we are honest about that, if we are honest that we are looking at competing pulls from many different directions, many different origins, all layered on top of each other in a way that nobody else is trying to do, then we can start to say a few things that we can do to address the problem. The first one is, stop telling these wonder stories about people who do it all, nobody does it all. It doesn't help anybody to tell wonder stories. Tell honest stories about what you really did to make it work. If you see someone who you think is amazing, instead of going over and saying you're amazing because that's not helpful, say, tell me one thing you do to make it work. She probably has something to tell you. Might work for you, might not work for you, but then you'll hear it. That's number one. Number two is don't give advice. Do not give unsolicited advice. Even if the people are your children, your grandchildren, your daughters-in-law, and you think they should listen to your advice, don't give them advice anyway. The world they're living in is not the world you lived in. It's usually not helpful. It's like basically always not helpful. Even when it's helpful, they won't listen to it, so why bother? The third thing is, on the hearing end, when we hear somebody say something about what they do that we don't do, or they do well that we don't do as well, or they don't do that we do but we wish we'd stop doing, practice, cultivate a habit of saying, that's so nice for you, instead of internalizing it and turning it into a judgment, and yet another way I'm falling short, and yet another way I need to be dissatisfied with my life. And finally, we have to really work to eradicate that culture of sleepless machismo from among Orthodox women, where she who sleeps the least wins. We have to recognize that sleep is a biological need the same way that food and water are, and that the same way that a woman who kept bragging to us about how little she ate, at a certain point we suggest she get some help for that condition. Somebody who keeps bragging about how little she sleeps is not doing any favors to herself, and we're not doing any favors to the culture we create. And together, I think we can create a culture as a community of women that says we are asking ourselves to do a lot. We are asking ourselves to do so much that no one woman can do at all. We can all make choices and as adults take responsibility for the choices we have made, what we are doing more of, what we are satisficing more with. We can all work actively, both for ourselves in being more satisfied, more shalem, and more at ease with the choices we have made, and for creating a culture in which we don't convey to other people that we are being negative, judgmental, or harsh to them because of their choices. Thank you.
Excellent.
Okay, I don't. Who's in charge here? Tell me when I'm supposed to stop saying. I'm happy. If you tell me when you want to wrap up, I'm happy to take questions personally after that. If people need to leave, you can feel free to go.
I know it was obviously intentional, but that the elephant in the room wasn't discussed, which is men, rabbanim, any of that kind of stuff, which it's very nice to have a community of women who strengthen each other, but we are operating within a rubric that is having a lot of expectations that need to be played with.
So let me say a couple of things about this. The first is...
We can't hear.
Okay, I'll repeat the question and then I'll answer. I'm sorry. Question was, what about the men? Where are the men in this story? Okay, both, I assume, the men in the home and the rabbanim in the community. Okay. So let's say a few things. The first thing is that Arlie Hochschild, whom I didn't end up reading to you, talks a lot about this, very much bekitsur. Arlie Hochschild says there are two models of marriage. There's a traditional marriage and an egalitarian marriage, and either one can work. What doesn't work is when you have blended, hybridized models in which the expectations don't align. What I was telling you from Naomi Wolf from Misconceptions is that I think there are men who think that they want an egalitarian relationship, who then, when the rubber meets the road, discover that they want a much more traditional relationship than they wanted. And the reason I don't want to spend so much time on this is because I do think that Deborah Spahr is very right in identifying our own internalized self-critique as a big piece of the problem. But some of the things that I gave from Ben Susan and the responses to them were very much about this discussion of husbands and what husbands are doing.
I think it's more institutional. I'm not even talking about husbands, but I'm talking about institutions that produce. I mean, I know that, let's say, for example, you wrote an article rebuking a recent kind of diminishing approach towards women in learning, right? Because Rabbanim had come down and said, well, maybe we really shouldn't be advancing women so much. Look what it leads to, or things like that. And our sons and our husbands and our future generations are all hearing this.
I would like to wall this conversation off from a very important but vastly much bigger conversation about the current state of women in the Orthodox community writ large. Because I think if we enter into that discussion, we lose the ability to talk about some of these things in a more immediate sort of way. That is not to say those issues are not very important and that I am very engaged in the discussions of those issues, but I don't think that if we turn this into that conversation, it's going to be so helpful for addressing this. I would say two things about husbands and sons here. One is that there are certain, everybody works their own working out, and that's true in your own marriage as well. And I think that when you say you must have this kind of arrangement, if your husband doesn't do X or Y, then you have not suitably, is again creating yet another demand. Oh, and on top of all that, I'm supposed to work out having an egalitarian marriage. Different homes have different arrangements. In my home, things have shifted over time, because that's a nature of reality, of different job responsibilities, of different numbers of kids, of different ages of kids. There were times when different ones of us, me and my husband, did different things, and that has changed over time. There are ways in which our division of labor is pretty traditional. There are ways in which it's not traditional at all. I will say that my son is in a school that has school on Sunday and is off on Friday. My oldest son, who's 15, my sophomore in high school, and he cooks. I call him from school. I'm like, here's what you need to make, and he cooks. Because I never understood that, and right, all the greatest chefs in the world are men. I'm not quite understanding why people can't cook for Shabbos being men. But my husband doesn't cook. And I think that part of our working out our things that work for us is dealing with that. I do think that these are important conversations to address, but if the upshot became something else to feel guilty about, that I haven't done enough to make my marriage an egalitarian marriage, I wouldn't find that helpful. The broader conversation about women in Orthodoxy is a broader conversation, but not one.
The expectations that they're coming into, that as much as we as women can together strengthen each other, there's an expectation that is out there.
So I will say a final word to that and then we'll move on to another question. But I don't think that, I think it is more complicated than that men are imposing those expectations on women. If you look at the Haredi magazines geared primarily towards women readers, Mishpacha, Ami, Bina, Family, Friend, these things, I sometimes save them. I keep saving them just for like illustrative purposes, even though then I never use them for anything. triple-layer chocolate mousse, Shavuot dessert with chocolate curls and ribbons and frou-frou and fluff. There, no man got anywhere near, not the production of that recipe, not the production of that magazine, and not the consumption of that magazine. The magazine is put out by Frum Women. It's being consumed by Frum Women. Frum Women are deciding that what I should really be doing is now having a three-color chocolate mousse layer whatever dessert, as opposed to saying, I'm going to buy cheesecake from the bakery for Shavuot, and that's grand, thank you. So I do think that there is room to address the expectations we impose on ourselves, which I don't... Now, they may be imposed on ourselves in a societal construct of an Eish HaSachayil does this or that, but the guys are not creating the recipes for three-layer chocolate mousses. We are, and then we're feeling bad that we're not making them. So we could just all stop. Yes?
I'm sorry that, you know, but I agree kind of what Donnie just said. The expectations when we got married, it was that we would have a profession, we would have a house, we would, yeah, look great, and we can do it all, but I understand all your advices were amazing, but our husbands and our community, they're still having those expectations that you volunteer and you're a role model in the community and you work for the community.
The boys were raised.
Who does cooking is up. Who does shopping is
up. Okay, so again, there are two different issues here, and I'd like to separate them out. One is, to what extent are we in fact taking on these issues in our own homes? I do not want you to think that I'm not suggesting that we take them on, that we not sit down and have conversations about what's working and what's not working, what needs to be recalibrated. As I said to you, that happened many times in my own marriage over the course of marriage. This arrangement that worked for us at a certain point doesn't work for us anymore, and we have to rethink and recalibrate. I'm not suggesting that that doesn't have to happen. But I also do think that a kind of, there's a piece of this, as much as I am aware of institutional pressures and everything else, there's a piece of this of like, okay, I am going to make a grown-up choice right now that I'm not going to be involved in the PTA for the next 5 years, or that these are not... That doesn't mean that there aren't broader... But I think that gets back to the peer pressure is us point. Okay, so people would like to be involved in the PTA, and what happens when you say no? Okay, so you say no, and then what? And then nothing. What happens when you serve takeout for a meal? What happens when you use paper plates? Those are the pieces that I'm talking about, us letting go of our own expectations of ourselves. For those of us who need to sit down and have conversations with our husbands and say, this arrangement really isn't working now, it needs to be recalibrated, that's a conversation you need to have, if you need to have it. Or that you may need to have multiple times. It's not like it's a one-off and done, because this stage of life and that stage of life are different stages of life. But I think that this is a place where I think the model of the outside that doing to us doesn't give us everything we need to get, because there's a lot more agency. There's a lot more ownership of our own choices and our own decisions and our own feelings that we as women can take here. There's a question coming to you.
Well, just a comment about making grown-up choices. I mean, one grown-up choice is that you can't have it all. You might not be able to be the best professional if you have to spend more time at home, and I think that one of the challenges that we have is being able to say, when I get married and I have children, I now have to shift or divide up my responsibilities. I can't have as much fun as I used to have when it was just me. And I think that as a greater society, not just the Orthodox community, that's our biggest challenge, to be able to say, how do I not do everything that I really want to do, and but as opposed to what I have to do. My final note is, you as an educator have exposure to many children, not just the children in your family, and you can see the effects on children when the parents don't necessarily make what I'll call adult grown-up decisions and decide to do things, even though it's not what they want to really do.
So there's a famous graph of happiness in marriage, and the graph of happiness in marriage you may know looks like this. It's a U-shaped graph, where you start off in marriage very happy in your marriage, and then if you stick it out, if you stay married, there's a period of time which coincides with the period of time of raising young kids and everything else, where the amount of satisfaction and happiness in marriage goes down considerably, and then as you get on through life, it increases again. It's a hard sell. Get married and raise kids, and you'll be miserable for 10 or 15 years in there, but then after you get out, it's going to be okay. There was actually an article in the Times a few weeks ago that suggested that women, because they were in fact contributing this broader service to society by raising kids, and the cost of that more, the burdens of that more often fall on women, that women should be a guaranteed income, that even women who stay home should sort of receive some salary from the world for their contribution they're making to the world, to Yishuv HaOlam, as we say in Torah sources, to the settlement of the planet by raising children, even if you know, because it imposes costs, and it isn't always the funnest thing in the world. I will say one thing about teaching and looking at kids. You do not see any kind of correlation between success, well-being, health, happiness, mental health, whatever it is of kids, and whether both parents work or whether parents stay home. There is no such correlation. There are correlations between those kinds of things and parent availability for engagement with and everything else their kids. I can't even tell you, I've had students over the years who are functionally living at home alone as their parents travel here for a few weeks and then go there, and we try to get in touch with them to talk about a problem with the kid, and they'll get back to us in 3 weeks when they come back from, but then it's just another 2 days before they're jetting off too. So there are definitely things that we see working with kids and engaging with kids. What we don't see is that the product, I don't know how you could read that however you want, but we don't see that the product of a stay-at-home mother is particularly necessarily predictably any better off than the product of a working mother. Yeah. Okay, I'm happy to stay and talk to people who want to talk to me afterwards, so feel free to come on up.